Hi, and welcome everybody to our second episode of our fifth season. It's around that area and topic of recidivism and new emerging technologies, trying to understand without any expertise on what's going on when it comes to incarceration, what are some of the necessary policy reforms that are out there, having a general discussion with people who just know things. They just know things, maybe not about particularly this topic, but there's always a really, really interesting conversation and dialogue to be had. So just as a quick introduction, this is the Voices Project Dialogue. For those listeners who've been avidly following us, this is now our fifth season, which is really, really nice to have. And it's going to be a season that is actually one of the most, I'd say, fraught with complexity. Our last season around mental health particularly was such, and it resulted in some great outcomes, you know, hopefully in the case of improving mental health and the understandings thereof. But today we're going to try to get into an insightful decision or conversation, that kind of bridges this very at face value disparate world. So AI, everything we're hearing about AI every day, literally every minute, it looks like as if our world has exploded in this technologies. It's never ending. How does that sort of converge in the area of global healthcare and particularly around social initiatives? So it's interesting to try to see this in the context of new technologies, not just specifically healthcare, but in this instance, social health, right? So in terms of the kind of issues related to, you know, offending behaviors and so on. And it's really great because today our guest is not only an accomplished figure in global healthcare, and a real thought leader and someone whom I've admired for years in navigating complexity. You know, saying, no worries, I'm going to give you a chance, Craig, in a bit just to give yourself a proper introduction. This intersection of health, behaviors, science, technology, societal well-being. So please join me in welcoming Craig DeLarge to the show. Craig, give yourself an introduction, please.
Yes, all right. It is good to be here. And thank you again for the invitation to engage you on a very important discussion, this new season of the Journal Project Dialogue. So I'm a digital mental health strategist and researcher. I have my consultancy, the Digital Mental Health Project, where I use many years of experience that I have as a digital health innovator in the life sciences industry, coupled with almost just as many years as a mental health educator, advocate, and caregiver, to produce education and research products that assist company founders, professionals in the mental and behavioral health space, and investors in implementing what I call a responsible adoption of digital technology. And this is relevant not just to healthcare, but also to social care, as you said earlier, which kind of gets us beyond just the doctor's office and into the areas of prisons and schools and other areas of society that also have a significant impact, not just on individual, but also on population health. So it's good to be here, and I'm looking forward to a really productive conversation today.
Thanks a lot, Craig. I mean, this is going to be fairly flowing because it's so hard, isn't it, to try and put this into any kind of a parameter. For our listener, some context. This is stemming from a broader study on the potential of impact of technology, the inclusivity. I think, Craig, you just mentioned it, the impact and inclusivity, or right now maybe exclusivity, of AI, and ultimately how could it work in this area of recidivism reduction. So what is recidivism? Essentially the tendency for certain societies to have a fallback into behaviors that takes people back into incarceration, back into prisons, and looking at research that tries to understand what are these multifaceted aspects that, first of all, falls, you know, gets back into recidivism, but how do we look at technologies and societal reintegration, and that in the context of global healthcare. And Craig, I really was so to you because you spend time here in Singapore, in Asia. Your wealth of experience also covers North America and the US where you are. And we couldn't come from more two polar opposites, could we, in terms of the way that incarceration, also the prison systems work. So I think a really interesting maybe place to kick off is describe for our listeners a little bit about how you see or how you think the prison system currently, I guess, looks where you are and maybe how that relates to others that you might be familiar with.
Yeah, so the carceral situation that we have here in the United States, and it's not just the U.S. I mean, this is happening in other parts of the industrialized world also, is really vexing. So, you know, a trend that we see in societies generally is that outgroups tend to be an above index representation in any carceral population. So when you look at the situation here in the United States, people of color and people of lower socioeconomic status are going to be an unfortunate overrepresentation. The other complicating factor that we have here in the United States is that culturally, we have largely taken a retributive versus a rehabilitation stance. It's not that we don't have programs that see incarceration as an opportunity to do rehabilitation, but kind of the philosophy that tends to dominate more often than not is retribution. There's something wrong with the person and we need to punish them, versus the person has had certain circumstances of life that have either traumatized them or put them in a state of scarcity where they didn't see an option other than crime, or they felt that the way to survive or thrive in life was to enter a life of crime, and thus they end up in the system. And then a third factor, really unfortunate, is privatized incarceration. We have, as the preeminent capitalistic society on the planet, found a way to make money out of imprisoning people. And so there are prison corporations, you can actually buy equity in them on the public markets, who, like any business, need a supply of prisoners in order to continue to grow its market valuation. And so on a too regular basis here in the United States, we discover that there are judges and other members of the justice system that are engaged in kickback and, I'll leave it at that, in kickback sneak schemes where they are sending young people into this system. I've read reports about how the forecasting of the number of cells that are going to be built are based on the birth rates that are occurring in certain zip codes in the country. And we also have instances where some states build extra cells and actually then offer to take on prison population from other states for a fee. Now, this all makes sense if you're talking about inanimate objects, right? This is just market activities, but it's a dreadful thing when we think about human souls. And then the other thing that I ought to also mention is in the United States, slavery is still legalized when it comes to prisoners and citizens that are convicted of crimes. And so there are just certain perverse incentives that we have in our society that really drive us towards being among regretfully in the top of the ranks of nations that have the highest or among the highest percentage of its population incarcerated and in prisons. So yeah, unfortunate situation. We appreciate the dynamics that cause it, As you can see, lots of perverse incentives. But I should also mention that on the other side of that scenario, we also have an active and growing prison abolition movement here in the United States that are seeking reforms and moderations, suggesting a move back towards more of a rehabilitative approach, and the two sides battle all the time.
It's fascinating. I mean, fascinating because it's not as if, you know, one doesn't know that, but the realization as you articulated, you know, now let me put it from, let's say, the side of the world where I'm at, where mm-hmm. the usual suspects are always the ones who tend to sort of always be considered the lost causes, will tend to sort of fall into the area of, let's say, being incarcerated, having something along the way that gets into the prison system. And I sometimes wonder, is the prison system, now regardless of which part we're talking about, there's an absolute, it thinks of itself as this contained whole, that there is basically nothing outside before or after. You know, the before part, what actually draws people to sort of have the capacity to create, to sort of do crime or to fall into some sort of behavior that gets them into prison, is not necessarily as much the prison system's concern. What happens as they exit is, to an extent, if you try and think about, you know, productivity, GDP, societal health, community health, but it's sometimes, I always marvel at how, when you get into the ecosystem of the prison system, it's a world into itself. It's almost like you're living in this, like, kind of end-to-end universe. Isn't it strange sometimes when you just think about, you don't think about the before and perhaps even the after? It's a strange feeling sometimes.
Well, you know, one might say that any society is made up of a collection of institutions that sit, that have its own bureaucracies, rules, and culture, and that citizens find themselves either working to get into those particular institutional bureaucracies, or they get trapped in them, right? So the same way we think about prisons, there's academia, there's the government, there's corporations of various types, there's nonprofit, there, right? So these are all institutional bureaucracies that work to play a role within society. And, you know, it's just unfortunate that I guess what we call the prison industrial or the carceral industrial complex is one that is available. And I would dare say that very many people in that system, I don't think there's anyone who intends to be in that system. Society is such that people get funneled or trapped or traumatized into. There are lots of different theories and hypotheses. And then once you're in, like all institutions, you learn the rules and you figure out how to survive, get power. Some people dominate, other people kind of play the frontline pawn. And when you look at it, it's not much different than corporate institutions that we grew up in. It's just that that was a different one. And I have to tell you, you know, I'm African-American male. And so as you can imagine, I can reflect on a handful of instances when I was young in my adolescence, where if I had stayed on that street corner 5 minutes longer, when my mother said, "Craig, be home in time for dinner," I would have been swept up. And my life would have gone in an entirely different direction. And that thin, you know, probability is not in any way lost on me when I look at the number of my childhood friends, some harder working, smarter, right? Comparable or better grades, but they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it sent their life in an entirely different direction.
Yeah, no, it's exactly. We see that a lot. I mean, you know, when you think about some of the, you know, the issues that lead folks into, let's say, not just here in Singapore, but even in Southeast Asia, into the prison system, you can almost see just how, you know, easy it is to be in that wrong place at the wrong time, right? I mean, it's not easy for everybody, but there's just more chances and more opportunities, sadly enough, that you will be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I think sort of, you know, if you go back 20 years, right, I mean, there was always societal surround sound that might have always played a role in that. It could have been in the home, it could have been outside, it could have been the play yard, it could have been, but you would have thought that as social media started to come about, as popular culture began to get alongside in, you know, certain social media channels, the release of mobile phone devices, so that any point in time, one thought, right, that this is going to be the great social equalizer. It's going to democratize the right information to the right people at the right time. What do you think? I mean, do you think in that way, the initial bits of where we were 10 years ago, 8 years ago with new technologies emerging, you know, the ability for someone, whether they were a fifth grade pass out versus a PhD, they were still able to see the right information, but not really because then misinformation and disinformation. So do you think in a way technologies began to almost create or accelerate that sort of divide or that, you know, push into inequitable, you know, access?
Well, one of the things we can say about technology that I think is pretty universally true is that technology doesn't really do much on its own. It only accelerates or amplifies the conditions that already exist, right? So if you contemplate that, there is this potential for technology to democratize and equalize, but it is more likely to do that in an environment that is already moving towards equalization and democratization. But if you put the same technology into an environment where there is a lack of equality, isolation, stigmatization, criminalization, then that technology is going to amplify and accelerate that also. And we have a habit of kind of holding up the exception as the rule. Well, a few people were able to escape the effect, so how come all these other people couldn't escape the effect? But I think that it is more true that a few people escape, but the majority of us as human beings really cannot overcome the environment that we're in. It's a really slim chance that you can overcome environment. So, you know, that has an upside and a downside. Certainly in my work, I'm always thinking about how can we have a second wave of use of technology that exhibits a skillfulness and a level of group and individual agency that allows us to use it to benefit ourselves, where we can clearly see that this first wave has harmed us in a lot of ways that were unintended, but are also the case. And then it's unfortunate that there's more profit, more immediate profit in teaching people, or at least not keeping people from harming themselves, right? So you look at the industries that capitalize on our use of technology in ways that are healthy for profit, but not unhealthy for us and our communities. And it's quite daunting. I just finished reading this book called Digital Minimalism by Cal Newport. He's a computer science professor at Georgetown University here in the States and has this website called The Deep Life. And he talks about this idea that we really need to slow down and learn how to use technology to support our values rather than being used by technology. And right now we're being more used by technology and the companies that profit from it than we are using technology to support our own health, our own values, and our own advancement.
Yeah.
So that's my thought about that.
Well, so let's stay on that vein, because, you know, I think what we've seen, particularly around the world, the whole disruption, what we call here in Singapore, was the circuit breaker. So essentially it wasn't a lockdown or anything like that. It was, you know, done in phases and everything, but it created, we began to see some very disturbing subcultures or trends, you know, when it came to vaping, for instance. It's like water flowing in a stream, you block one thing, it'll find another route. And when it came to mental health in particular, it also was quite, you know, I would say not worrying, but insightful as a researcher to see that there was going to be some concerning new trends coming out of COVID. Now, what one didn't anticipate was the acceleration of AI. And when you think about it from a digital, you know, mental health research perspective, and coming back to this idea of, you know, what it is to be in prison or perhaps out of prison and thinking about now, how am I going to get my life back together again? I mean, how and where do you think the potential for some of these tech applications could actually be impactful? So, you know, rehabilitation, yeah, for instance, you know, re-entry and back into society, reduce, yeah, recidivism. Is there good that perhaps can come out of this accelerated life that we're living in right now?
Yeah, there absolutely is. And, you know, the applications that we see for technology to help us, and let me clarify, to help us where we have offered permission, right? So nothing about us or done to us without our permission, and where there are appropriate constraints around ethical use that does not do harm or which put people ahead of profit. Those are two very important provisos, right? That you have to always kind of state up front. But assuming those conditions are in place, technology has wonderful opportunity to help us. And I'm going to cite what I like to call the four roles that technology can play when it comes to health, whether that's physical, mental, or social health. So technology accelerates and amplifies our ability to educate ourselves, right? The democratization of information. Now, what we educate ourselves about is another determination. But the point is, anything you need to be educated about, you can accelerate and amplify that education and customize that education better with a smartphone than you can in a classroom. All right. And with some modifications, I want to say that for the classroom teachers who would say, absolutely not, Craig. And they would have a point depending on the context, right? The next is training. So no education becomes action unless we get an opportunity to practice and train with it. Right. If it just sits in my head, that's one thing, but I need to handle and work with it in the three-dimensional world in order for it to become productive behavior. The next, social support. Few human beings can make any significant change in themselves outside of the support of a community of those that encourage, that model, that mentor, and that hold accountable. And of course, this is what social media does. It's just that what we're being held accountable for is not always so healthy. But we can be held accountable for healthy things, you know, in like fashion. And then finally, measurement. So the nature of all change in behavior is two steps forward, one step back. I make a commitment to something, I start to work on it, and then I get exhausted. I get discouraged, I get impatient, and then I think, oh, let me stop doing this, let me go do something else. Well, measurement is a way of showing us the progress that we are or are not making. And the digital technologies that we have give us the ability to do that through self-reporting, through passive measurement, the various sensors within our phones. And so when you think about, again, education, training, social support, and measurement as the role that technologies can be designed to play. Frankly, they've already been designed to play that. It's just that the design that predominates is to get us to shop, to get us to work, to get us to be entertained, right? But, you know, let's take this now to the specific context of incarcerated citizens, okay? So while a person is incarcerated, you can see how education and training, social support, and measurement in order to prepare them to be productive returning citizens, that can work. And by the way, when we look at the literature, it's not that this isn't happening. There are already studies and pilot projects that we can find where this sort of thing is happening. I found some research at the website of the National Institute for Justice here in the United States, and we could put this in the show notes, right? Where these types of projects are already happening and being tested and showing some positive results, okay? So preparation for re-entering society. Then when someone is released from a carceral state, they're either going to be fully released on some form of probation or parole, we see that these same four uses of technology can be used to get them up to speed on aspects of the society that they had missed while they were incarcerated. It can connect them with resources. It can give them exercises that help them to move more towards those behaviors that are going to renew their citizenship versus result in them being rearrested. It can provide them with a social community, not just one that's immediately with them, but that community can be spread out geographically, but still supportive. Because one of the great hazards of reentry is that you're re-entering the environment that had the conditions that set you up to be incarcerated to begin with. And a lot of recidivism is about that, right? I can't escape the family, the community, the friends, the economic means that got me into this situation to begin with. And if I don't have some way of associating differently with a different social community and network, then the probability of me being back in that same situation is going to be pretty high. And then when we talk about tracking. So I think that we could agree on some level that very many antisocial behaviors are directly related to stress on some level, right? And let me go further to say distress. So I find myself in a situation, my amygdala is triggered, I become emotionally and psychologically dysregulated. Under threat, I act before thinking, and that action is sufficiently antisocial that it breaks a law, and now I'm in the system, right? Okay, well, here's the thing. We know now in the area of digital phenotypes that our smartphones can know when we have become emotionally dysregulated even before we do, okay? It can track continuously, and it can track longitudinally over time. It can correlate for us people, environments, locations, situations, and factors. Heart rate, speech patterns, amount of sleep. These are all factors and others that when correlated can teach any individual a lot about where do I find myself when I am most likely to be in distress, to become dysregulated, and then to repeat some behavior that got me in trouble in the past. If we can use our phones and other digital technologies and sensors as a way of monitoring our stress, that then educates us about situations that we need to stay out of, then we're going to do better as a result of that, yeah. Right? And so these are the ways in which technology is beginning to be used in a pilot fashion, and which we can advocate for its further expansion that can actually result in preparing people for reentry, and then when they reenter society, giving them the conditions and the resources and the ability to self-quantify so that the chances of them re-entering a carceral state is reduced. And then I should add, if we want to take a preventative approach, we actually can use technology to reduce the probability using the same four roles that people end up incarcerated to begin with. And that's an even better solution, right? So yeah, this is what we've been researching and thinking about, and it's possible. And then let me say this, we also need to create a business and a profit model around what I just described, right? Because it's going to be difficult to execute what I just described at scale if it's in fact more profitable to not do it and feed people into the carceral industrial complex. And I think we got to look at both sides of that, right? Got to look at both sides, yeah. Because, you know, we're human beings. We're incentivized. We're motivated by certain things. And if we don't change the incentives, it will be nearly impossible to change the behaviors at both an individual and at a systemic and structural level. So I'll pause there. I know I said a lot, probably went on too long, but let me pause and hear what you think about that.
No, Greg, you so eloquently compress it all that I make notes to sort of keep up with how fast your mind works. And I'm still at a point of saying, well, you know, technologies always have this advantage. And I think you just concluded by saying having an incentive, almost like a for-profit incentive. The technologies always have this thing, and it was created by social scientists and, you know, psychologists and psychiatrists who went and were creating these algorithms on stickiness. And it's like, you know, it's like literally, you know, heroin addiction. It's like you can't stop. You know, some of the data that's coming out is that they were measuring the amount of sleep people get. And there's celebration sometimes in technology is that, great, we reduce sleeping by 2 hours. Well, you know why? It's because they were continuing on some sort of mobile device. Even when someone says, I'm going to bed, they're not going to bed.
Yeah, so
next 2 hours, so able to get off this thing, right? And you're right. Trying to counterweigh that by saying, well, So here's my point that I wrote, and I'm going to have to try and backtrack it to where you were a few minutes ago.
Okay.
If you're, as somebody who's getting out of the prison system and thinking about, right, look, I have a second go at this. Let's say that, you know, I've got a supportive network. I've got the right sort of, you know, attitude. I'm going to make things happen. But sometimes, isn't it a bit like Stockholm syndrome, that if you almost go back to saying, I'm going to trust the very system that put me in here the first place to give me the kind of technology or the kind of habit-changing kind of, you know, systems, yeah. Thing, like, isn't that a little bit like, I don't know this. Am I falling in love with my, you know, kidnapper kind of thing? It's like, you know, so this whole idea that the only things that are out there for most people is to default to, let's say, you know, general social media. And I just want to make a point again that what we're seeing is almost like this geopolitical attack now on so many different social medias that you don't know which one to trust. The latest one now being with TikTok in the US and ByteDance, the Twitter kind of situation, and, you know, where things are at. And more recently, if you look back with what Sam Altman and the, you know, OpenAI vision mission was in 2015, he was actually going to do what you were saying. He was like saying, this has to follow those four protocols, right? It's going to do no harm. It's got to be for everybody. It's going to be the insulin of the 21st century. It's going to be there for all. And you had people like Thiel, you had people like Elon Musk, you had great sort of like, you know, evangelists of the future of technology. But today there's lawsuits and there's no, and then there's Microsoft in the pick. And so how do you then end with this sort of like very correct outline that what can you do to leverage technology that's going to allow for a progressive, like a bit like, you know, have the guardrails as long as you need it, and then you'll be able to find your way through it. But how do you do that in this sort of absolute conundrum of fighting of technologies?
Yeah, so I'm going to invoke two terms and then we can do some unpacking. One is digital literacy, right? That we're not literate about these tools and how they impact us. And it's not that there's not research. I mean, Netflix had a very popular series about this, right? And there are all kinds of books that are coming out, Digital Minimalism, the one I mentioned earlier being one of them, where we need to be more literate and we need to make sure that our children are more literate about how these technologies have been designed to capture us. And then the other one is digital citizenship versus digital consumership, right? So you know, let's pick on social media. So the big social media companies, right? Meta, Twitter, let's stay just with those. Although we know there are others, right? Well, it's to their advantage to have us be digital consumers, which is kind of a mindless scrolling, liking, sharing, posting. But digital citizenship is a state where I'm mindful. I have an intention when I'm on these platforms. I'm constantly monitoring for how my use is reflective of my values. I'm putting ring fence around the amount of my life. I want to use life versus time. The amount of my life that I'm giving to the platforms versus giving to other things that I value and that are important to me. So we have to recapture. We have to become more literate. And then we have to become citizens. Citizens have agency. Consumers, not so much. And then get this. Let's go back to the four roles. We have to deepen our education. We have to install and be true to practices. We have to make ourselves accountable to social communities that agree with us and that will encourage, mentor, model, and hold us accountable. And then we have to track our use. Because unconsciously, we will drift back into consumership. So we have to understand that as a human being, I'm prone to comfort and convenience, which is what consumerism is about. But I have to make sure I don't get lost in that, so that I continually renew my commitment to citizenship, which is not about as much about convenience and comfort, but it's more about responsibility, accountability, and exhibiting values. So, you know, as elders and parents and leaders in the society, we need to practice this. We need to model this, so that our children see it, and that's where the hope is. The hope is in the children. And when we say, well, you know, this is hopeless, it's largely hopeless because we as elders and leaders, parents, have modeled hopelessness. We have not disciplined ourselves, and then we turn around and say, well, how come our children aren't disciplined? Well, we're not disciplined. I'm sitting at the dinner table with my smartphone, with my grandson sitting across the table. I'm saying to him, no smartphones there, but I need my smartphone so I can catch an email that might come from a client. Well, guilty is charged. Guilty is charged. And I've been really challenged by that, by reading this book, Digital Minimalism, that I have to do better if I hope for my children and grandchildren to do better.
We're going to have this link for sure. And, you know, I think, like, I mean, I think it's a sign of the times when in our family chat, we actually got a separate chat that just says memes. And that's because, you know, we got so addicted to literally sitting around the table or in our idle time, instead of like saying, you know, hey, did you know something really interesting? We're just sharing memes, which is literally, and then the other guy will laugh. And that's, but the issue, like you said, rightly, is that digital literacy, like most people said, well, it's a generational thing. Don't worry, it'll get better. But it's something, like you said very rightly, digital literacy and digital citizenship is two very different things. Well, it's actually two very similar things, but then it gets muddled up.
Well, they're different than consumership.
So exactly, consumership, right?
Consumer versus citizenship. And you might say literacy versus illiteracy. We are digitally illiterate and digital consumers. We need to be digitally literate and digital citizens.
So think about it from somebody, and I'll say it more from a Southeast Asia standpoint, doesn't have the chances from the get-go. Let's say, you know, parental absenteeism, you know, lack of education to that extent, even though education is readily accessible, just, you know, sort of is part of a community, you know, typically in the minority communities where it's just sort of those things, right? It's just passed on from one to the next. And you're really on that path before you even are to that level. Just forget about being self-aware, but even being properly digitally literate. You know, we talk about younger generation as being sort of like digitally native, but I'm sure you have that. I think our young folks are perhaps digitally native. They know exactly how to kind of get onto things, but all they know is how to consume, and they're not really sure about what it is that they're getting. So you're widening this gap, and you're allowing consumption of media that accelerates the chances of you getting into things. And I guess then once you're in there, I guess the question is, does the prison system allow you opportunities to reform or find the best foot forward and just stay out as much as possible? So ethics and morality. Go ahead.
Well, this kind of gets at the root of what do we believe the purpose of prisons are? Do we believe the purpose of prison is to punish and brutalize a deficient character that we're afraid of? Or do we believe that the purpose of prison is to help people who have stumbled onto a wayward path to rehabilitate themselves, to learn and develop themselves in ways that they can re-enter society and be a productive citizen? And I want to catch myself, even me using terms like re-enter society is an unconscious bias. It's an unconscious negative bias, because to think that the prison is not also society shows that we've exiled people.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So it may be less re-enter society and more improve one's contribution to society.
Wow. I mean, you also touched on something that I wanted to make sure we had the time to get into, because your outlook when it comes to from the origins of, let's say, digital mental health, a lot of that, and you mentioned it, is about the ethics of, let's say, a dialogue or conversation or citizenship, or, you know, what is it that we need to strive for as a community? And let's say in communities that are just more prone or just have just the sort of, you know, lack of, let's say, the system, you know, giving them the best possible chances. So talk a bit about the ethics as we may see it right now. I know it's really like looking into a fuzzy little cloud, but the ethics of, let's say, AI and technologies. Now, I'm not aware of any formal national or global guideline, much like we have healthcare frameworks, right? Like these are the kind of protocols and regulatory frameworks and whatnot. What do we have, or what should we be thinking about when it comes to the ethics of AI? And I will take a reference back, I think, to our generation maybe, but, you know, things like Clockwork Orange, for instance, right? So, I mean, you know, you don't want a face which is, or, you know, even more recently than that, like Minority Report kind of things where you're, you know, it's always nice to take, you know, media examples of movie examples, but it's the best way to say that sometimes the fear is always the predictiveness or preventing predictive behavior almost stereotypes even further if you're training AI models to say, here's a set of profiles or here's a thing. Now, if you're, let's say, somebody who's at risk or in the system or getting out, if you're immediately AI profiled and everything else sort of... there's very few movies that so far you can sort of look back and say, now that was a really good outcome, wasn't it?
Wasn't no, always. Usually not. Usually not, right? And the good outcomes tend to be less publicized because, you know, as human beings, we spend more time concerned about what may harm us than what may benefit us. It's why we're here, right? We are all grandchildren of that, of those that were good at managing risk and harm. So let me address this. AI has great value and benefit, but also can do great harm. We know now that the algorithms that underpin artificial intelligence, for reasons I'm not quite sure we understand, carry the biases of its programmers. And yeah, I don't think we understand why. I mean, some people think that there's a spiritual element to this, right? But it's a fact. I actually looked at a study, and we can put this in the show notes, that kind of came to this conclusion, and I'm hope I'm saying this properly, that in instances where AI is used, there, again, you see this bias come out, where it has a tendency, oh no, you know what it was? It was assessments about inmates.
Wow.
Where you're trying to make a decision about, given their characteristics, should they get a larger sentencing? And if they come up for, I think, probation or parole, should you trust that they will be a good citizen? Are they ready to come back into society? And it showed this bias that people of color, this is an American context, the algorithm was more harsh towards people of color. And I think that was also true of people who were poorer, right? Okay, so I don't think that means that we don't use the technology. I think what it means is that we need to be literate and aware, and that we need to be constantly safeguarding against the bias, which means you've got to bring human intelligence. This is where we should think of it not as artificial intelligence, but augmented intelligence. AI is not here to replace my intelligence. It is here to supplement and to augment my intelligence, right? And so we need to be continually interrogating these algorithms, knowing that they have bias, reprogramming them to root out that or to minimize that bias. And then, you know, to the augmented intelligence needs to have accountability guardrails just like human beings do. So, you know, in an ethical society, we don't have any situations where there is not an auditor of human action to make sure that human beings don't become overly selfish and self-interested. I think we have to do the same thing with this other intelligence, whether you call it artificial or augmented. Now, you talked about regulation. In my research, I did uncover that the EU has an AI Act that is developed and under refinement. I'm sure we have such in the US. I just need to do some additional research around that. I'm sorry I didn't have that in time for this talk. And so, yeah, there are lots of regulators, legislators, advocates, and ethicists that are looking very closely at this. Some of the organizations that I would recommend that people look into as a follow-up, the Center for Humane Technology is a really good one. And they actually have a free course in ethical technology that I recommend. That people engage with. The other is the Algorithmic Justice League, right? Which is also doing lots of research and advocacy. They're really playing the watchdog role around the development of AI and kind of sounding the alarm around where we need to be holding it accountable, where we need to be wary. Again, all technology has harm, right? I mean, an axe, a hammer, can destroy my hand or cut off a limb. We don't not use the technology. What we do is we continually explore ways of using it safely. And again, this is where literacy and citizenship becomes important. But if we're going to maintain the posture of illiteracy and consumership, then the AI is going to be allowed to do whatever it wants. And yes, it's going to harm and damage us.
Yeah, no, it's
so buyer beware, as they say, buyer beware.
Yeah. It's funny because literally you ask anybody, even about 15 months ago, would they even think AI would be a practical day-to-day life of everyone? And, you know, it would have said, what, are you kidding? And then as of today, it's even getting into curriculum. So to your point,
oh yes,
AI in master's programs, at least here, even in IB programs in schools, yes, are now accepted to an extent of saying, yep, as long as you can show us your prompt. What's also interesting is prompt engineering as undergraduate studies, even in Harvard. So you're basically
new data science.
You're not coding anymore. Yeah. You're just going to be a really good prompter. So you,
yes.
I think the idea that, look, bring collaboration together, think about the expertise, have the safeguards and watchdogs. You were reflecting when we spoke earlier on the organization, like the Center for Public Safety Innovation, CPSI, that's trying to.
Yes. Yeah, that was another one. Thanks for mentioning them. Yes.
It sort of comes back full circle in a way that what you start off by saying that it's, you know, the nonprofit ecosystem and the world of the privatized consumer system, you know which one's
going.
It's a David Goliath situation. Now, somehow we've got to find a way to build that value and not just be we're just here to create this little, you know, thing and, you know, get lost in the.
Yeah. So, you know, the value proposition that we I think a lot of people refer to as civil society, right? These are the nonprofits and advocates that play a counterbalance to self-interested, private, for-profit interests, which has its role, but any role overdone causes harm. So here's kind of the role. I think you had asked me in an earlier discussion, what did I believe the role of these, of civil society or these nonprofits in? Well, lobbying for laws and policy that advocate for lower barriers to change, right? In this case, the change is holding the AI accountable. The AI adoption is going to take care of itself. The change we need is responsible AI adoption, okay? Conducting research which builds the literature and the thought leadership, because it's in literature and thought leadership that we grow our literacy and then can be good citizens. See how those two go together, right? Act as ethics watchdogs. So watching the boundaries that get crossed as these technologies become more advanced and making sure that legislators, regulators, citizens, and advocates know about it so that we can be more literate and more citizens. And then convening, benchmarking, and educating around effective practices and effective cases. So these are at least four roles that organizations like the Center for Public Safety Innovation, which, and their work is specific to the carceral system and institutions, but then more broadly, the Algorithmic Justice League, the Center for Humane Technology, and there are other, you know, organizations of this sort that are doing the work to help us stay on top of this advancement.
They say, right, that there's a saying that goes, may you live in interesting times. And some people think, that's a nice blessing. Thank you so much. And they're like, no, actually, that's a bit of a curse. So the idea of living in more interesting times than this, where we're talking about humane technology, augmented intelligence, not artificial, you know, because these are now become not Isaac Asimov or Ray Bradbury or anything like that. Now this is here. Now, what are we going to do? And I think this has been such a generous contribution, Craig, just in being able to hear you and your ability to just bring and distill these critical matters together. We're up on the hour, actually, just to show you just wow.
We sure are, aren't we? And I could go another episode if you wanted to, but I know we got to limit our time.
Yeah, that's why this is a topic where, you know, as specialists, perhaps coming over from the healthcare side, this is something that we're now just grasping and getting to kind of come to terms with. And I think we need to apply that same rigor as we were taught. So
agreed.
Yes, before we kind of look at, you know, wrapping up and trying to sort of, you know, move this forward, any thoughts, anything? I mean, you've already done a beautiful roundup as it is, and I wouldn't want to put you on the spot, but anything that you think our listeners could walk away with just in a brief context?
Yeah. So one, I would say that as citizens, we need to grow our awareness and understanding of the harms of the carceral institutions in our society. And where we are so compelled, we need to be advocates of those citizens that have found themselves in this situation and work more towards rehabilitation than towards retribution. Right? Because in many cases, these incarcerated citizens are members of our own families. So that's one thing. The other thing, we need to continually grow our digital literacy and our digital citizenship. And one of the things, I'm going to provide you with a number of links, a couple of blog posts I've written, as well as links to the book that I refer to. Because if we don't grow our literacy and our citizenship, there is no one coming to save us. There is no one coming to save us but ourselves on this count. If we don't get ourselves together around this, then all this talk about democracy and civil society and all this sort of stuff, it's not going to happen. This is not something someone else is going to do for us. We have to do this for ourselves in our communities. And then the third thing that I would say more broadly is, again, as citizens, let's stay aware of the ethical and the regulatory issues related to these technologies. And we're so compelled, put ourselves in a position to speak up, to use our power, our influence, and our privilege in order to keep proper guardrails around these technologies so that I like to talk about the Promethean dilemma. So, you know, Prometheus stole fire from the gods. The gods are angry about it. And the dilemma, and this is a metaphor for technology, right? And the dilemma always with new technology is, like fire, can we cook dinner without burning down the house? Right? So fire is good, right? We can cook dinner. But if that fire gets in control, then it burns down the house. And so here we go again with artificial and augmented intelligence. Can we cook dinner, get the best value of it, but not burn down the house, harm ourselves, destroy society? You get my point.
Oh boy.
So thank you very much again, Rohit. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Craig. Craig DeLars joining us today, shedding not just light, but I think such critical, vital thinking on this intricate, hard to grasp connections or interconnectivity between AI technologies, societal health initiatives. If you found this discussion valuable, well, boy, there's more to come. This season is one that we're not approaching any real sort of like plan on. The idea is that let's speak to people who matter, who have a point of view. So stay tuned for more episodes where we're going to explore this and many more issues. And Craig, I'm sure we're going to have you back again as part of our culmination.
Yes.
Of our other speakers as well. Thank you so
looking forward to it.